inspires your positive growth and change? Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Aware Show. Hi, this is Lisa Garr. Good to be with you guys today. We are, of course, in for a really great show. A lot of good things to think about. First conversation we're going to have is about overcoming our fear, basically, and burnout at the workplace. But first, I just want to make a quick announcement to talk to you a little bit about the teleseminar series that we do with the Aware Show. It's the fourth season of this, so we've been doing it for about a year now. Every 3 months on, 3 months off. Well, we're in the middle of our fourth series, and it happens right after the live radio show on Wednesdays and Thursdays at 3. It begins live on a teleconference line. The phone calls are completely free. We are doing today, we have, I'm interviewing Carol Look, and we're doing a ton of tapping processes on the call later on, which is really going to be great. Really interesting stuff. We're going to do a process that's going to help eyesight. That there was this big study done on, this big research study done on. We're going to be kind of conducting a similar type of experiment on the call. So join us at 3 o'clock. You can find out more about it at theawareshow.com/teleseminar. And you can join us today. If you missed today at 3 o'clock, it replays all weekend. So, or for the next 2 days. So you'll catch it either way. All right. So here's a question for you to ask yourself. Are you burnt out with your job or at your workplace? Are you finding yourself putting on a fake smile, stressed out, overreacting to small situations because of stressful situations that you can't react on? Do you see a purpose in what you're doing, or is this just a 9-to-5 type of thing? These are some of the signs of workplace burnout. And joining me today is Dr. Pillay. He is a stress and anxiety specialist and the author of a book called Life Unlocked, 7 Revolutionary Lessons to Overcome Fear. Welcome to the show, Dr. Pillay. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, yeah, this is a really pertinent information, very relevant to people today who are afraid of leaving jobs because there are just not that many jobs out there according to unemployment. And they're staying in jobs that they're not satisfied in or tend to be afraid to leave, and then they just get burnt out. Is that what you're finding?
That is correct. You know, I think stress is definitely taking a toll on a lot of people's lives, you know, partly because the demands are really exceeding the resources that people have available to them. And I think you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book, Life Unlocked, was because I wanted to highlight some of the biological constructs that underlie some of the fundamental tenets of burnout. And, you know, in the particular situation that you're referring to, people are often afraid to leave their jobs. But that fear is not necessarily a conscious fear. It may also be an unconscious fear.
What do you mean?
And I think a lot of people sort of ask the question, oh, really, is fear really unconscious? And we know from experiments in fear that if we show a threatening or fearful stimulus to a person between 0 and 10 milliseconds, nothing in the brain will register this. If we show them the same stimulus between 10 and 30 milliseconds, the unconscious brain will register it, and above 30 seconds is when the conscious brain starts to register it. So when we put people in a brain imaging scanner and we show them a threatening stimulus, you know, for example, if you had to be at work but you found that your job was threatening, that the fact that you had no upward mobility was threatening, you know, those would be the applications of that concept. If we show it to people between 10 and 30 milliseconds, they actually have no awareness that they've encountered the fear, but the fear center in the brain will light up. And the fear center is so sensitive to fear that even in blind people, it will light up because it picks up surrounding threats. So with burnout, what ends up happening is the initial fears actually register in the brain outside of awareness. So people are not necessarily thinking about the burnout because they're not thinking about, you know, am I really feeling burnt out? Because they're not really feeling burnt out. And what ends up happening is it's only when the burnout becomes conscious, you know, when you actually start having the thought, you know, I think I'm getting burnt out, I can't get out of bed, I can't really, people kind of irritate me, I feel cynical about work, I don't really want to go to work, I'm just doing it because I need to make the money. It's at that point that people start to want to make interventions. And the truth is, at that point, it's probably later than it needs to be, because it's possible to actually make these interventions at an earlier stage. So part of the reason I wrote this book was to highlight the fact that there are ways in which we can actually identify earlier stages rather than later stages. And I think it's important to know that even if we're not being consciously fearful or burnt out, if we're finding that our performance is affected, if we're finding that we can't attend or concentrate, you know, as you mentioned, if we have this kind of fake smile, it's important to start asking, is it possible that unconscious fear is beginning to eat up my brain resources, and try to make interventions at that point?
You know what, your information, I'm sorry to interrupt you, your information is so good, but there is a distracting sound in the background, so it's distracting me from really being able to hear what you have to say. So I'm going to have my producer give you a call right back. There's some type of a strange feedback in the back, but we'll hold on while she calls you right back. But this is, by the way, my guest is Dr. Pillay, and we're talking about Life Unlocked. How do you really know if you're burnt out at the workplace, as Dr. Pillay was just explaining? It's through the subtle stressors and anxieties that start to build up that cause this type of burnout. And then how all of this relates to fear is very interesting, and he's going to talk about this. He said some of the things that people act out in the workplace when they realize that, or they don't realize that they're under this type of stress, are things like infidelity. We've seen very talented leaders have affairs and so forth. Well, what's really going on in their brains is fear, complete unresolved fear. And there is a science behind these impulses that causes, and there's no excuse for this, by the way, and there's a whole part of the book that he talks about, no excuses. But this is an unconscious fear that can be reduced by recognizing it, but unrecognized is out of control, and it acts out to these types of things. It makes you powerless. It causes you to lock up in terms of emotions or have irrational emotions and so forth. So then it affects the people in the workplace around you because misery, of course, loves company. And people literally can mirror neurons in the brain and automatically reflect others' emotions and intentions, whether it be fear, negative. That's how a whole workforce can actually turn negative if one person, you've heard that one bad apple spoils the whole bunch. So are you back on the line, Dr. Pillay?
I am.
Ah, wow. It's so much easier to hear you now. Thank you. There must have been something on our line, but that was just too distracting for me. Okay, good.
Okay.
Moving on now. So I was talking about something like this earlier about why very talented leaders have affairs and how this relates to fear. Can you explain that?
Sure. Well, one of the things about talent is that in order to engage talent and creativity, you have to engage the frontal lobes of the brain.
Okay.
And when you engage the frontal lobes of the brain, what you're doing is you're actually disinhibiting the brain so it can tap into creative things a little bit more.
Okay.
And once you tap into these creative things a little bit more, what ends up happening is you start to take more risks. And when you start to take more risks, this can spill over because it becomes a slippery slope. And the risk-taking part of the brain, which is required for innovation and creativity in order to express talent, may then start to influence other areas of your life, which is why when you do have talented leaders who are in positions that require a significant amount of innovation, the disinhibition or the release from stuckness that's required in order to become innovative, may generalize to other areas of function.
Interesting. Now, that doesn't give an excuse by any means for people to go ahead and have affairs because they're innovative and creative.
No, but I think it's helpful to know that, because I think that if people are aware that embarking on these kinds of intellectual courses can create that kind of vulnerability, they can become a bit more aware of their behavior in other domains of their lives.
Okay. So let's get to the root of all of this, which is the fear, bottom line fear. In the workplace, you were saying earlier that that it's the countless issues of stress and anxiety and so forth that is kind of a sleeper. It accumulates over time, and it causes these either burnout or more radical behaviors like we just spoke about. How do we resolve something like this? How do we recognize it and deal with it if it's constantly there?
Well, there are a couple of different things. You know, in general, one of the things that I recommend is sort of trying to get an assessment so you know what stage of burnout you're in. Burnout can exist in right from the stage that you mentioned, which is sort of having the fake smile, all the way through to feeling first cracks and then perhaps some kind of dread stage, and then physical and emotional exhaustion.
Okay.
And then in order to figure out what to do, you have to figure out what the predominant cause of this particular burnout is. And the cause could be work overload, lack of control, insufficient reward, a breakdown in the community, the fact that the environment is not fair at work, or that there are conflicting values.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you do, you know, the most superficial interventions are that you try to target whatever the cause of the burnout is. If you feel like there's work overload, for example, you can talk to a boss about an alternate time structure. You can strengthen yourself and increase your resilience by eating well, exercising well. You can subcontract or delegate your work or tasks to other people. You can prevent duplication of work. You can prioritize what's important and what isn't. You know, when it comes to factors like lack of control, you can ask yourself, am I being micromanaged? And can I speak to someone about making a plan for greater individual control?
Well, let's talk, what about if you work for the government and there's systems and structures in place that have not been changed for hundreds of years that maybe are not working any longer but would take a lobbyist in order to change?
Sure. Well, you know, I think as you're pointing out implicitly, what I'm recommending is that this would occur in the most ideal circumstances. I think if you could do one or two of those things, it probably will start to make a change in your life. If you're working in a very old-style bureaucracy,
mm-hmm.
There are two basic things to remember. One is, how do we view things and how do we experience things? Now, in the book, Life Unlocked, one of the things I explain is that the amount of fear or distress you feel within any situation, for example, within a bureaucracy, is related to a certain extent to what you pay attention to. Like, a lot of times we feel that if we pay attention to what's causing us stress, we'll be able to solve the problem. But the truth is, the brain actually needs time away from the stress-causing events in order to come up with innovative solutions to deal with things.
Oh, that makes sense.
What we do see is that, you know, if you take physical pain, for example, and you take two groups of people, you take one group of people who concentrate on the pain and the other group of people who don't, even if you administer the same amount of pain, paying attention to the pain actually makes the pain feel like it's much greater.
Really?
So, there was actually a study done recently, published just about a week or two ago, which I think, you know, listeners, certainly I found it fascinating, which is that the brain codes for emotional pain in a very similar way that it does for physical pain. And lo and behold, the study, which is published in a very reputable cardiac journal, showed that Tylenol was able to relieve the pain of social rejection.
Really?
Yes.
Wasn't funded by Tylenol.
No, it wasn't funded by Tylenol. And so I think because it was the first study of its kind, there will need to be replicated studies. But
yeah. To
me, what that study shows is that physical pain and social pain are subserved by similar brain structures. And that if we take our attention off of the pain that we're experiencing emotionally, just as in physical pain, we will experience that pain as being less. So as a short-term intervention, when you're working in bureaucratic structures within government and you feel like things can't change and you're experiencing the pain of the stuckness, to give your brain some time to come up with innovative solutions about how to work with the environment, it's important to recognize the fact that paying attention to it may not actually make it feel better necessarily.
Okay, so what are you supposed to do? Distract yourself at work?
So distraction can actually help for short periods of time. But another sort of attitude, and again, I'm starting with the more abstract things and sort of we'll get to things that are more concrete, but distraction itself is one of the interventions, which literally is a helpful intervention at times like that. I mean, I think if you distracted yourself all of the time, it would be impossible. You wouldn't be able to get any work done.
But positive distractions.
That's right. Positive distractions or distractions at critical points in the day to give your brain a little bit of a break so that it can come back to working out what it needs to work out.
So those could be things like contests or an office party or things like that?
Absolutely. Or you can ask yourself, well, you know, is there something that I can do to make myself feel better about my overall week? Do I have a massage scheduled? Do I have a night out with my friends scheduled? You know, when you set short-term positive goals for yourself, it actually does help out a lot when you're trying to figure out what to pay attention to in a difficult work situation. And I will often say to people, depending on what gives you a specific amount of relief, ranging from massage to music to a day out shopping, it may sound, you know, superficial and superfluous, but the truth is those kinds of activities can actually help a lot.
Okay, I've been in a work situation before where the people or maybe a particular person that I work with just for some reason we're like oil and water. I don't know what it's from, but when we get together, you could feel the tension in the room. I could get all the massages I want, but it's not going to help me when I walk in the room with that person. I need some different skill sets in order to deal with that type of stress.
Mm-hmm. So in that particular situation, the tension that was being caused for you was the tension that was existing between these other people and not between them and you?
Between me and another particular person.
Okay. So in terms of that, you know, the concept that you were talking about earlier on, I think, does apply. You know, the first thing to recognize is that when there is tension, emotions are contagious because we have mirror neurons, and we can quickly take on the emotions of another person. So at the most overt level, I think, you know, it's probably not necessary to say, but important to remember that if you can speak about those tensions, it would be great. But in a lot of situations, it's kind of pointless to speak about the tensions because people are defensive and not open to talking about what's difficult.
Right.
But I have often been with people where in work situations, they would go up to someone privately in an office and say, you know, I notice every time I show up at work, there's a lot of tension that exists. And what I was thinking was, it would be important, you know, the one common goal we do share is to be able to do the work that we need to do in this environment. And I'd like to be able to lessen the tension by either exploring why the tension exists, or if you don't want to explore this, just to accept that we can agree to disagree about the numerous things that we do, but still know that we're united by the fact that we have a common goal, which is to finish the work that we're finishing. You know, that kind of overtness can take some of the heat off the unspoken tension. Having said that, there are a lot of people in a work context with whom it's impossible to speak. And in that situation, this distraction idea can actually be helpful because rather than focusing, you know, there may be 100 things about a person you don't particularly like, and there may be 2 or 3 things that you can objectively comment on. So if it's an appropriate situation, you know, you could say good morning and say, by the way, I really appreciated the report you sent out 2 days ago. Or if it's someone you feel comfortable enough commenting on something like, you know, nice pair of shoes.
Right.
You know, you can actually, what you do is you force yourself to focus on the positive, to start creating positive emotions because that's what you really want to happen in the environment at that point.
That seems like...
Having said that, a lot of people will say, yeah, but I don't really feel positively about the person. I feel like the tension continues to exist and I don't really like them. And so part of what I will say is, well, what we've been talking about up until this point are more superficial ideas. You know, when I think about the name of the show, which is, you know, Aware Radio, what we're trying to do is go beyond superficial interventions, become more self-aware, more other-aware, and to realize the things that cause tension. So, you know, for example, if we become aware that there are certain characteristics about a person that simply will not change or are very unlikely to change, in those situations, you can become less tense because you're not walking into work every day saying, I wonder if they're always going to be in a bad mood, or if I wonder if they're always going to be unpleasant,
right,
or I wonder if they're always going to be rude. By simply expecting that they are always going to be rude, it doesn't surprise you. You know, it's often this unconscious hope that we have that people are going to change or that we can change them
right.
that makes us feel thwarted in the moment. So, you know, again, the first level were the concrete interventions that I mentioned. The second level are the kinds of interventions that we're talking about. The third, I would say, relates to probably what the crux of the show is about, which is about true awareness. What is awareness? And a recent study has shown that if you take two conditions, one being cognitive reflection, where you think about the situation and you analyze it and you try to figure out what's going on that's wrong, and you take another condition called emotional introspection, which is simply placing your attention on the tension that you feel inside of you. Wherever you feel it in your body, you simply take your attention and turn it inward. What we see is that the brain's fear center, the amygdala, decreases in activation with emotional introspection. It decreases when we simply place our attention on the emotion without judgment or analysis. But when we ask a lot of questions and we're becoming analytical about it, the fear center can actually increase its activation. And what this relates to in terms of awareness is actually mindfulness. It actually relates to the fact that if we become more mindful, and by mindful, what we're referring to explicitly is aware of our emotions without judging them or without being overly self-critical or without feeling like something needs to happen, without feeling that we have to change something, because a lot of times, it's really not within your control single-handedly to change something. If we can simply go through a process where we place our attention on our emotions, our entire brains will actually respond differently because decreasing the fear center activation releases your thinking brain to think more clearly and to interact more clearly.
That's what I wound up doing was I wound up, this person wound up being such a great teacher for me. Was all that I was going through in the resistance that I was in to her, I turned it around and wound up just having so much gratitude for her being in my awareness because it gave me the opportunity to learn from that experience, to learn about how to not be a victim, but to instead be in a place of complete and total kindness. And it wound up working out really great because it just really wound up being a very, very positive situation. So once I got out of that, I can't possibly relate to that type of person. I surround myself with really good people. You know, once I popped that bubble, I realized, hey, this is something I can absolutely treasure and learn from. And it wound up working out well. So I like what you're talking about. You talk about it, of course, from a more scientific perspective, which I love because you have great data behind something that I just experienced. So you just explained to me what it was that went through my mind. That's a great way of approaching it.
Thanks for saying that. Because, I feel like a lot of times people feel that, spirituality and science are somehow completely different things. But the truth is, science is simply another metaphor for spiritual experiences that people have. And, what you were describing now, which is taking an attitude of kindness and seeing an obstacle not for the obstacle but for the opportunity that it gave you to make changes within yourself, has also been backed up by science. And specifically, people have looked at what they've called compassion meditation and have found that compassion meditation creates a greater coordination of different parts of the frontal lobe of the brain and allows for a greater feeling of restfulness and better thinking and functioning at work. So again, I think that your approach to that was perfect because rather than feeling like you had to take all of that responsibility on and feel like, rather than take on a whole set of existing obstacles and assumptions, you chose to turn that into an opportunity for self-development and also to change your own experience in that work environment, it sounds like.
Wouldn't that be nice if companies could take that on? I mean, that was just a small level, but what about the companies that really run their companies based on fear, of consequences and so forth? You know what I'm talking about, like maybe some larger corporations.
Absolutely.
That feel that they need to do that. So wouldn't it be nice if there could be a different approach for something like that? I mean, how does that influence a company that's being run by fear, basically, not a positive working environment?
It's often a very negative influence. Anxiety can be organizing up to a point, like when we have deadlines and when we try to bring up, but at a certain point, you start getting diminishing returns. And so because the fear center of the brain is connected to the thinking center of the brain that's involved in decision-making and risk-taking, the shock waves from the fear center start to reach the thinking center, and so the company is actually decreasing the productivity of its employees, and it's actually decreasing the productivity of people around, which is why my general recommendation is to be highly sensitive to the anxiety index that's at work. Because a lot of, you know, a lot of leaders believe that the way to motivate their employees is to stress them out some more so that they'll do more work.
Right.
But the brain can only really tolerate stress up to a particular point. Beyond that point, you start getting diminishing returns. And I do agree, therefore, that for companies, it's especially important to be sensitive to whether the anxiety is organizing or whether it's in the way. And even if there are no immediate sort of thoughts about how to decrease the anxiety, remember, anxiety is an emotion and it can spread as well. If you don't take action early on, you stand the risk of the anxiety spreading throughout the company.
I have a great example of this. A friend of mine owned a steel company. He made products that had to do with steel. And they had a very high incidence of accidents at the company. There were a super high number of people who had accidents, and there was a policy in place that there were consequences when people had accidents, and the more consequences that were put into place, the more accidents that happened at that particular organization. And he turned it around, and what he did is he put a game into place that validated the employees, and they got incentivized based on how good their safety rating was. And he incentivized them enough and validated them enough that it became a zero-incident facility. So they had a 100% safety rating because everybody started to participate, look after other people. There were more eyes on safety than ever before, and it wound up working out to everyone's benefit because nobody else got injured. Everyone was playing the game of safety, and it was a much more positive working environment for everybody rather than fear if something went wrong.
There's actually a really neat piece of science that backs up that particular phenomenon. One of the questions that people have asked is, why is it that when we focus on not doing things or on negative things, we often end up doing them? The classic example being sort of having a glass of red wine at a party and not wanting to drop it on a white couch, and the next thing you know, it's all over the couch. In the case of the company, they're saying, no more accidents, this is really bad, we're going to have a negative policy, and all of a sudden you get more accidents.
Right.
Well, what brain imaging research has found is that when we are under situations of stress or fear, the conscious brain, which is involved in consciously preventing these kinds of things, starts to turn off. And all we're left with is the unconscious brain.
Hmm.
And because of the condition called priming, the unconscious brain does not hear, do not drop the wine, or do not cause the accident. All it hears is drop the wine or cause the accident. And there have been experiments that have shown that this is what the unconscious brain is hearing.
Really?
So under conditions of stress, the unconscious brain is following that instruction and doing what apparently it thinks it, you want it to do. Which is why, when you have a strategy in a company, it's really important to be able to orient the company toward positive and proactive strategies rather than these kinds of sort of warning strategies, which often get people to do the very thing that they're trying not to do.
That is so interesting. I've always heard that about the eliminating, the not cancels out in any particular sentence like that, but I didn't know there was actually scientific validation behind that. That's
right.
Fascinating.
There is. The unconscious is such a powerful, variable. Like most people in relationships and in work situations, think that because we can listen to our rational minds, that our rational minds are really the greatest determinants of outcome. But the truth is, more and more experiments are showing that the unconscious brain has a very significant impact on outcomes. And if the unconscious brain is very sensitive, but it also leaves out information because it has to respond so quickly. And so if we're in a situation where our primitive brains are reacting first, then our awareness is compromised, and what we want is most likely not going to happen. And what we want to do is create some kind of synchronicity between our conscious thought processes and our unconscious processes as well.
Do you believe it's possible to change the unconscious?
Yes, I do. And I believe that from a number of different variables. One of the things that I do is I coach people, I coach executives, I also do therapy. And I know that in a number of clinical situations and in a number of executive situations, people have explored situations so that once they've understood what's going on in their unconscious, they've been able to change that. But to back that up scientifically, when we look at some of the therapies, like cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, or like mindfulness meditation, or like transcendental meditation. If we look at the actual impact of the brain, we see that parts of the unconscious brain, like the fear center, the amygdala, can actually change in their activation as a result of these interventions. So we can rewire the brain by introducing the brain to different approaches, such as mindfulness or transcendental meditation or cognitive therapy. And, you know, medications can do that as well. So I think we have enough evidence to show that the unconscious brain can be accessed and rewired.
Absolutely. That's really fascinating. I wonder if you can explain the science behind why we fear our greatest potential. Why we have a fear of success, basically. What is that?
Well, one of the things that whenever I mention fear of success, often to people who are moderately successful, at least, they're always denying it because they feel like, come on, you know, consciously, of course I want to be successful. I want a better job. I want more money. The reality is that behind some of these fears lurk a lot of unconscious narratives or constructs, and these are all coded in the brain. So, for example, if you are successful, you may want to be successful, but you may also hold other thoughts such as, if I'm successful, I'm going to have to maintain the success. If I'm successful and have a lot of money, people may want more from me. If I'm successful, there may be too much of a focus on me from other people. If I'm successful, I'm going to be ahead of the pack, and as a result of that, there's going to be no one in front of me, and I'm going to actually have to lead, and I'm going to feel disoriented. Now, those are just four of the many kinds of fears that I outlined in Life Unlocked, but if you think about what's going on in the brain, there's a competition going on between your simple conscious construct, which is pulling you in one direction of, I want to be successful, and then there's this blasting of this process from your unconscious fear centers, basically saying, whatever actions you are trying to take to be successful are going to be thwarted because the unconscious brain is going to send these fear impulses to disrupt what's happening in your actions towards success. And so when people fear success, they're having opposing constructs going on in their brains. And even though they're not conscious of their fears of success, they might find that their progress is slower than they want it to be. And so what I'll often say to people is, yes, it's impossible to know what's going on in the unconscious, but if you feel like your life is not going in a direction that you want it to go, if you feel like you're not attending or concentrating, or you can't quite see the solutions, or you can't quite feel optimistic, ask yourself, are there unconscious fears that I might need to come into contact with, and how can I deal with these?
How can you deal with them? Yeah, that's usually the question. So I have this, if I'm too successful, it will take me away from my family. But I do not know how to figure that one out.
Well, so there are a number of different ways. I think, you know, apart from more spiritual interventions like meditation or psychological interventions like therapy, if we're looking for a good way to start doing this, what I'll often say to people is there a way that what we essentially have to do from a biological standpoint is tap into the conscious brain in a way that will allow the conscious brain to then influence the unconscious brain. And one of the ways that I will sometimes ask people to address this is to say, well, what can we do differently to the unconscious brain, to the conscious brain, to change its relationship with the unconscious brain? And you can essentially, you can refocus, you can reframe, just as two simple interventions, some of the things that you're thinking about. So, for example, if in your situation you were thinking, if I'm successful, I'm going to feel more distant from my family, you could ask yourself, what are the ways in which my success could enhance variables in my family?
And then I would start figuring that out, right? My mind
You would start figuring that out.
Very good.
Then you'd be asking your brain a very different kind of
question.
Okay. And you might also, you know, you often find this, you would think that by now this particular phenomenon would not have occurred in women, because women are so successful, are increasingly becoming the majority people in corporations. But there's still a lot, my experience has been that there's still a lot of ambivalence about the relationship between femininity, wiseness, sort of being part of a relationship. If I'm that successful, am I going to make my partner feel less successful? There's only a limit of success I need to have to handle things. And these are the kinds of questions that I think limit people, because there are ways in which you can start to think about not just how you are affecting the other person, but how you can work together to enhance both of your goals.
Yes, and that whole part of mothering as well, which I find is extremely, my biggest job really is that of a parent. And I look for other models of women who are really successful that have also been really, really great models for their children and really good parents and present for their children. And sometimes it's hard for me to find that women that can do all of that.
It is difficult. There was a study done recently that actually looked at senior managers who were about to retire who were all women. And there were two findings that relate to different poles of what you're talking about. One of them was that for a subgroup of women, what they did was they did a study saying, you were women at a difficult time in the history of women's evolution in corporations. How did you manage to become so successful and so senior? And there were two things. One group of people said, well, what I did was I followed a male expectation, so I was unattached and therefore flexible. Uh-huh. And as a result of that, I was seen as being competent and was able to perform my job. Huh. But there were another group of people who were mothers who said, actually, being a mother allowed me to understand how to work in chaos in a way that I would never have been able to understand had I not been a mother.
That's a great reframe, yes.
And so when I came into the corporation, what I actually saw a lot of the times were just a bunch of babies trying to all make it in the same environment and not knowing how to do that. And so what they did was use their mothering skills to both nurture but also set limits and advance the agendas within their specific division.
Brilliant. Wow. Well, you're just fascinating to talk to. I thank you so much. You validate a lot of the thoughts and the confusion that I've had. So it's been really, really great to at least speak to you on a personal level. I hope my listeners got that same benefit because you really do have a lot of great ways of quantifying things that I've either heard or felt. So great book, by the way, Life Unlocked, Dr. Pillay, P-I-L-L-A-Y. And thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. Really fascinating.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We'll talk soon, hopefully. All right. We will be right back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to The Aware Show.